Welcome to our Food Principles module on the Weston Price Diet. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to present to you one more in our series of Food Principles presentations, and I often call them the food dogma or food religion area, just because there's just so much craziness around it where people just like think that these particular food principles are things that we have to follow to a T like we would dogmatically a religion. And it's really not that way, as you've been learning throughout this process. So before we jump right in and begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that everything that I teach in this and all presentations is not meant to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not meant as medical advice. And when you're sharing this information amongst your clients, that you make sure that you're telling them the same, that if they're on any medication or under the care of a doctor for any reason, that you should always talk about the particular health challenges that you're having and what particular nutritional changes that you want to make before you begin. So that all said, let's start with a little levity. It's about eating the diet that's right for you. And sometimes we kind of get bored with it, right? And your clients are going to come to you and say, hey, I'm bored. I've been eating this way for XYZ. What can I do for variety? And sometimes you can give them variety. And other times, if they're on an elimination diet or there's particular reasons they need to avoid things, you're going to have to just, you know, help them to live with it. So the caveman turns to the other caveman and said, I'm tired of hunting and gathering too, but nobody's invented grocery stores yet. Right? So let's just take a look at the Weston A. Price diet. So who was this man, Weston Price, Weston A. Price? He was born in Canada in 1870, and he died in 1948 of a heart attack at age 78. He was a dentist, and the dentist who studied nutrition, dental health, and physical health in indigenous cultures. So as a dentist, he was wondering about the health of people's teeth from cultures to cultures, saw a lot of degeneration in the modern world and wanted to see, well, what was it like in the non-modern world? Now, granted, he only lived to 1948. So his studies, his work may not reflect everything that's true of us here in the 2010s. He founded the National Dental Association. He was the chairman of the American Dental Association. He originated something called the focal infection theory, wrote a book called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration in 1939. And what he concluded was that perfect physical form and health occurs only with the consumption of nutrient-dense whole foods and specific activators found exclusively in animal foods, or he said animal fats. We're going to learn later what that mysterious activator factor actually is. He founded the Price-Pottinger Nutrition Foundation in 1952, and they were known for research where they fed cooked food and raw food to cats and saw the changes that those foods had when they were cooked versus raw in the health and the dental structure of the cats. The foundation that's named after him was not started by him. He had no part in that. It was just named after him by his followers. It was founded by Sally Fallon and Mary Enig to basically disseminate his research and move forward on their own interpretations of it. So his focal infection theory is actually some dental research that was done on endodontic therapy, pulpless teeth, and broader systemic disease. And focal infection is a localized infection, right? It's not symptomatic oftentimes, and it also can cause disease somewhere else in the person. So he was looking at focal infections specifically in the teeth that were creating problems elsewhere. And that what he concluded was that after root canal therapy, teeth routinely hold bacteria producing potent toxins. And this has been verified and studied further by the work of Hal Huggins and the biological dentist movement that he founded. So the focal infection theory resulted in many people getting extractions, both of the teeth, but also tonsils. It was unpopular until the 1930s. It was practiced after the 1950s, and it was later, you know, carried on somewhat, but not completely, by Hal Huggins, who founded the biological dentistry, but not until the 1980s. So these guys did not have any overlap in their work study stuff. So this is a book that Pottinger wrote, and he wrote the details of these travels he did while traveling around the world and looking at diets and nutrition of various cultures. He found that the Western diet, the modern Western diet, flour, sugar, and processed vegetable fats causes nutritional deficiencies. And remember, this was back in the 40s, not in the 80s, 90s, or the 2000s, when we are even worse off with processed foods, much, much, much more processed food out there, and food manufacturers actually vying for the food dollars of the public by enhancing those processed foods to make them more palatable and more delectable. The Morton collection of human skulls at the Penn Museum shows changes from perfect dentition to buck teeth and weak chins that occurred around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And their theory is that that had to do with the diet, and that nutritional deficiencies cause many dental issues as well as many health problems. And we see so many people. We rarely see a kid that escapes unscathed from dental cavities, but also seeing that there's changes in the facial and jaw structure as a result of the poor nutrition, the shape of the palate, the shape of the jaw, the size of the jaw, as well as tuberculosis and heart disease as a result. So let's talk a little bit about the Weston A. Price Foundation diet history. So it was founded by Sally Fallon. There she is pictured there. She has a BA in English, Stanford University, I'm in English, so she's not a nutritionist. She's not studied nutrition. She founded the Weston A. Price Foundation, and she also founded a campaign for real milk and wrote a book called Nourishing Traditions with Mary Enig, several other books. It's based on the supposed culinary customs of our ancestors. So it has a lot of good things in there in terms of fermenting foods, but I will take exception to a lot of things in that book and with the Weston A. Price, and you'll get my opinions as we go through that there's a lot of things in here that I don't believe are in our best interest, and we'll just say that. It's the non-official cookbook at the Weston A. Price. I've heard her speak. She's opinionated, and she's very dogmatic, let's just say. So the foods that they exclude, great stuff for them to exclude. Low-fat, skim, homogenized, processed dairy products, raw commercial eggs, hydrogenated processed oils, farmed or processed seafood, commercially raised meat, meat containing additives, canned or processed food, GMO soybeans and soy, alfalfa seeds and sprouts. We'll talk about that more later. Peanut butter, hemp seeds. Interesting. Alcohol and coffee, food additives, and sugar and refined flours. With the exception of probably hemp seeds and sprouts on that list, I would say great list of excluded foods. But the things they recommend tend to be very heavily animal food based, with the big, big emphasis on dairy. Whole dairy, of course, grass-fed cows, which is a good thing. Eggs, pastured, soy-free. Organic oils, olive, coconut, and palm. Cod liver oil. Fat. Lard, tallow, and suet, all pastured animals, but this is just extracting the fat from these animals, organ meats from pastured animals, grass-fed meat, bacon, sausage, wild-caught seafood, whole in-season fruit, we finally get to some produce, lacto-fermented vegetables and drinks, nuts, grains, and legumes soaked, sour bread and sprouted bread, so they don't exclude gluten, bone broths and stock. So these are the lists. Now, I will say that a lot of the followers in this movement have died early deaths. Weston A. Price diet versus paleo diet. There's some similarities, but there's a lot of differences. In Weston A. Price, they eat the whole animal or get organ meat, and they add fat even to the lean meat. So the really big emphasis on extra, extra fat, whereas the paleo is more going towards lean muscle meats without the fat, both of them pastured. The paleo is no grains, whereas the Weston A. Price, grains are allowed, but they have to be properly prepared, where they're soaked and sprouted and then cooked. The paleo, no legumes. Again, Weston A. Price, legumes if they're properly prepared. Paleo excludes potatoes and includes some yams, whereas the Weston A. Price includes both of those. Paleo is dairy-free, vegetables and paleo is dairy free, whereas there's a huge amount of dairy. Raw dairy is the foundation of the diet on the paleo. On the paleo side, bone broths aren't mentioned, whereas on the Weston A. Price, they include a lot of bone broth. With the fruits and vegetables, the vegetables and fruits are supposed to be eaten with added fat. So I've heard Sally Fallon quoted to say that the use of vegetables is as a carrier for the fat. And with the paleo, it's fruits and vegetables without fat. They're not emphasizing fats, although fats like coconut oil and are allowed. They're more focused on moderate amounts of saturated fat on the paleo, 7% of calories, where on the Weston A. Price, they are focused on lots and lots and lots of saturated fats, unlimited amounts of that. In Weston A. Price, they emphasize salt. On the paleo, they don't. On Weston A. Price, chocolate and caffeine are not allowed, whereas on paleo, they are allowed. They're not a huge part of the diet, but they are allowed. So there's a little bit of a comparison because people will, you know, kind of equate the two because they both have meat as a focal point in the diet, but there's huge differences between the two. This is her food pyramid. Look at the bottom. The bottom is liberally, this is the mainstay of the diet, is this bottom tier. Dairy, including butter, raw milk, kefir, yogurt cream, sour cream, cheese, pastured eggs, bone broth, extra virgin cold pressed coconut oil. So the base of this diet is fat, pure fat. And then the next level that they want you to have at almost all meals would be meat. So almost all meals, you should be including meat with the skin and with fat and with extra fat even. Organ meats, especially pastured liver, oily fish, or shellfish. On the other side, which is good stuff, raw, lightly cooked, stewed, or lacto-fermented vegetables. And then they go up in the, you know, grains and legumes and nuts and seeds, small amounts. They want them to all be soaked, sprouted, fermented, germinated. Good stuff. With fruit, raw or lightly cooked, eaten with a protein or a fat. Now, in a lot of the food combining, and if we look at glycemic indexes and stuff, we look at avoiding eating fat with sweet because of the problem with it not really combining well. And then at the top, once a week or rarely, the natural sweeteners, including honey, maple syrup, rapadura, cold-pressed olive oil, sesame, and peanut oil. Okay, so that's their pyramid. Very, very, very different from some of the other pyramids we've looked at. Very different from even the paleo pyramid. Extraordinarily different than a vegan or a plant-based pyramid. Okay, so let's look at some of the foods to be avoided on this diet. Don't eat any white flour, refined carbs, sugar, processed foods. No more than 20% of your calories from protein. They don't recommend fish oils. Interesting. Chocolate, coffee or tea, alcohol, only allowed in moderation, industrial oils, corn, soy, canola, legumes, grains, nuts, and seeds must be sprouted, so they don't recommend commercial breads, and they leave out alfalfa seeds and sprouts, and we'll look at the mechanisms that they're talking about there in it just a bit. So most of this stuff is stuff that we all talk about leaving out of the diet, but there are some exceptions here that we'll talk about. Okay, so let me go to the next one. So what's the problem with seeds and sprouts? Well, they believe that sprouting increases some nutrients but also increases toxins, and the toxins protect the sprouts from animals eating them. In traditional societies, they soaked and sprouted the legumes versus just cooking them or eating them raw. They're saying that most sprouts should be cooked or steamed before being eaten to disseminate some of those toxins. And the toxin they're talking about is cannabinoid, which can be found in, especially in alfalfa sprouts. So what really is this cannabinoid that they're so concerned about? It's a non-protein amino acid that can be toxic in high amounts. It's found in leguminous plants. High amounts is key. We don't have a real good quantification of what that is. Found in leguminous plants. So in your legumes, your lentils, your beans, and things like that. It's structurally related to L-arginine. So L-arginine is one of the amino acids we talk a lot about. L-arginine is the one that is a precursor to nitric oxide. The difference between arginine and cannabinine is the replacement of a methyl bridge, a CH2 unit, in arginine with oxygen and cannabinine. So we know, though, that very small changes in molecular structure can result in very huge changes in the function. So you're saying that this is primarily accumulated in the plant, in the seeds of the plants that produce it, defends the plants from herbivores, and it's a vital source of nitrogen for the growing plant embryo. Now, you know, there are plant toxins in almost all plants, so I'm not 100% sure why this one was singled out versus the ones in buckwheat or versus the ones in celery, or there are toxins in just about every plant, and the reason is the same reason that they're talking about, to protect the plant from the predators. So I'm not 100% sure why this one is worse than others. So here's the controversy. They were saying that there's a lupus-like syndrome that was associated with the L-cannabinine, and it's been described in both humans and animals. Dietary supplements containing alfalfa were implicated in triggering this disease exacerbation. In 1981, there was a report that alfalfa seeds was the cause of an irreversible autoimmune hemolytic anemia and pancytopenia in a patient. Primates fed alfalfa seeds, alfalfa sprouts, or L-cannabinine, developed a similar disease with hemolytic anemia, or high titer of ANA, anti-nuclear antibody, anti-DNA antibodies. And when they took the alfalfa seeds away, it resulted in the resolution of this condition, although antibodies remained detectable for up to 2 years. So here's the thing. High amounts must be taken in order to produce the above amount of the above results. So you always want to question the study and the amount that was given to the test subjects. The primates were actually fed a diet of 40% alfalfa sprouts for 7 months. So my feeling is there is probably anything that has a toxic load, if you feed somebody 70% of their diet, could easily conceivably create problems. That's not the way people eat. That's not the way we eat. That might be the way some animals might eat in the event of famine, and all they can find is alfalfa sprouts. So the equivalent, the 150-pound human, which is an average-sized male, would have to consume about 14,000 milligrams of cannabinine all at once for it to be toxic at that same level, okay? So it comes down to taking studies and then extrapolating them to be valid as clinical evidence that something is either good or bad. So a generous helping of alfalfa sprouts contains no more than a few milligrams compared to 14,000. So personally, I think that their focus on leaving out alfalfa sprouts, given the amount of alfalfa sprouts the average person typically eats, which is a couple of forkfuls, is unfounded. They are a good source of vitamin C, folate, and other protective compounds. So I think it may be a little bit of hullabaloo. So what is this mysterious factor X that Price identified, again, back in the 40s, saying that there's this mysterious factor X that's only found in animals and that we must eat a lot of animal fat in order to be healthy? So he published a second edition of Nutrition and Physical Degeneration in 1945, adding this chapter on a new vitamin-like activator. Fat-soluble substance essential for utilization of minerals, whose absence from modern nutrition was responsible for the proliferation of dental cavities and other degenerative diseases. But he never really determined its precise chemical identity before he died. So for better means of identification, he just called it Activator X, and some people referred to it as the Price factor. He found it in the milk of several species, varying with the nutrition of the animal. He found it in cod liver oil, and he found it in specific high activator X butter. It was only present if animals were eating rapidly growing green grass. In most regions, this occurred in the spring and early fall, which would explain why the modern public tweets cows that may never have eaten a blade of grass in their lives, because they're fed in factory farms and they're fed grain and feed and they're kept, you know, locked up, they may never have this factor. So is why he's contributing the modern fall in and the diseases. So for over 60 years, everybody just called this Factor X. In the late 1940s, Royal Lee, the founder of Standard Process, suggested that it was essential fatty acids. In 1980, Jeffrey Bland suggested that maybe it was actually an elongated EPA. So what is Factor X? So Price texted Factor X. He quantified the ability of a food to oxidize iodide to iodine. Essential fatty acids can't do that. So the essential fatty acid theory was out. So the other test that he did was the idiometric determination test for peroxides, carbon-containing molecules that are damaged by oxygen. In 1972, there were some Danish researchers who published a paper in the British Journal of Nutrition, showed that that test could be used to detect biological quinones, such as K vitamins, in plant tissues. So you know ubiquinone is vitamin K. These K vitamins possess these oxygen-containing ring structures and are capable of oxidizing iodide to iodine, and therefore could be detected by his activator test. Vitamin K1, also called phylloquinone, is found in the green tissues of plants. Why these animals that were high in it were actually eating a diet which was fresh plants, you know, grown in the spring. When animals consume K1, their tissues convert part of it to K2. And then K2 is also produced by lactic acid bacteria, although that K2 is really different from what we get in animal foods. K1 is used by the liver to activate clotting proteins. It's used by the liver to displace calcium where it belongs in the bones and teeth and keep it out of the soft tissues, like, you know, when it deposits in joints or in arteries. So here's some structures. This is the structure of vitamin K and their various clinical behaviors. Okay, so by now we're thinking, is this mysterious factor X actually vitamin K? So these are the bonds, the single bonds or single bonds between them. A is vitamin K1, and B is K2, and C is what happens when they react with trihydroic acid by absorbing hydrogen atoms. So the side chain is the R. So if the mixture of the vitamin K and hydroic acid is combined with the starch indicator, the diatomic iodine liberated by the action would turn the starch blue. So in fact, they were able to determine that this actually did the iodine to iodine. So here's some things, comparative things. Factor X, they said it was found in the butterfat of mammalian milk, the eggs of fish, the organ and glands of animals. Where is the vitamin K found? The butterfat of milk, the organs of fat of and fat of animals, and animals, they weren't able to look at the fish eggs. What about where else? Synthesized by animal tissue, including mammary glands, from a precursor in rapidly growing green grasses. This is why where K comes from, including mammary glands, which is found in association with chlorophyll. And where else? The content of this vitamin in butterfat is proportional to the richness of the yellow and orange color. Same thing in vitamin K. The precursor is directly associated with beta carotene, which imparts a yellow or orange color to butterfat. It liberates the diatomic iodine, and so does the K. And it acts synergistically with vitamins A and D. And vitamin K activates proteins that signals that are produced by A and D. So in all, good conclusion is that this mysterious activator factor is actually vitamin K2. And this goes on, you know, to describe some of the other things, role in infant growth, role in mineral utilization, control of dental cavities, increased mineral content and decreases bacterial count of saliva, inversely associated with heart attack, protects against calcification, and increases learning capacity. So, voila. We really think that activator X is actually vitamin K. And if we look at where do we find it, yes, you can find it in animal products, but K2 is also found in natto. And if you look at the amount in natto, there's actually more in a serving of natto than there is in just about any of the animal products. So in fact, what they identified as something that was only available in animal foods could indeed be found in plant foods. Now, you need to be using natto to get it, but it's an easy-to-make fermented paste, mainly culturally associated with Japan. So the different kinds of K, which is this activator X, there's the MK4, metaquinone 4, and it's a synthetic version. And it's practically identical to the K2 that's found in animal fats. And it's used in Japanese osteoporosis studies. There doesn't seem to be any toxicity, and it seems to be pretty effective. The menaquinone 7, MK7, is the extract of natto. It's much more expensive, obviously, than the NK4, because MK4 is a synthetic, and it's cheaper to make. So the MK4 supplements, there's some by Thorne Research, Carlson Labs. The 7, MK7 supplements, Sorts Naturals has them, Jaros, and then Mercola has a K2 MK7 from natto. So it's a supplementable vitamin. It's also available in foods. And it's available in the same foods that we looked at before. Here's a warning about vitamin K2, activator X. Supplements interfere with the activity of oral anticoagulants such as warfarin. This is one of the biggest warnings in all of medicine, herbal medicine supplementation. If somebody is on warfarin, Coumadin, you've got to not supplement them with anything that's listed as problematic. You may work with their doctor to see if you can get the doctor to adjust the doses so that they can decrease their dose of the medication and increase their dose of some of the supplements. So K is involved here, vitamin E, the essential fatty acids, et cetera. So anybody that's using warfarin should only use K2 with the knowledge of their prescribing physician. Very important for you to remember. So let's look at the pros and the cons of the Weston A. Price diet. So great, it removes the top 10 worst processed foods, sugar, flours, processed foods. It advocates whole organic fresh foods, recommends animal products, only animal products that are grass-fed and pastured. It includes lacto-fermented vegetables and beverages, and encourages soaking and sprouting of grains and legumes. So it's got a lot of really good features. What's the downside? Well, there's so many animal products, I mean, up to 70% of the diet is animal fat, that it can be acid-forming. That high fat can be hard on the liver and gallbladder. So people who have a tendency towards weakness in the liver and gallbladder, they're going to be having issues here. The bone broths and fermented foods that they use are high in amines. So people who have histamine issues need to be really careful. The bones in the cartilage are high in FODMAP, so people who are sensitive to FODMAPs need to be careful. The bone broths contain glycine, and that can convert to oxalate, so people with oxalate sensitivity need to be careful. The diet doesn't necessarily remove gluten, so people who are sensitive to gluten will go on this diet and not get better because the gluten is still in their diet. A lot of dairy can be mucus-forming, and we saw that dairy made up most of the pyramid for this diet. It can be high glycemic if too many breads and grains. So they don't eliminate breads. They just have you do like the sourdough-type breads. There's a high emphasis on saturated fat, which a lot of studies can connect to heart problems. Dairy is the foundation of the food mirror, and meat is included in every meal. So there's not a tremendous amount of plant food. When we look at diets like, you know, the Walls diet, where she's got this, she does have meat in her diet, but she has a ton of vegetables. This is like the vegetables are the side dishes and the condiments, and like Sally Fallon said, a good carrier for the fat. What are some of the criticisms? Well, John Robbins reviewed the history of the foundation and provided evidence that Weston A. Price had actually recommended a vegetarian and dairy diet to his own family members as the healthiest diet. So there's a little discrepancy here in the translation between Price's death in 1948 and the foundation forming in 1999. The anti-vegetarian, anti-soy views of the foundation have been criticized as myths in several publications, like all soy is bad, all, you know, people can't be healthy if they're vegetarian. And I have outright heard Sally Fallon being interviewed, and when asked, like, well, you recommend a lot of animal products, and it was talking about pregnancy, what should pregnant women do if they're on a vegan diet? She said, vegan women should not be allowed to get pregnant. That was exactly what she said. They are being, it's abuse to their children. And I just about flipped. Joel Fuhrman, in the Truth About the Weston A. Price Foundation article, he argues that the foundation is a purveyor of nutritional myths, largely because they failed to update their recommendations in light of contradictory evidence. And there was a whole big battle going back and forth with them that I looked at years ago. And if you go to my blog and you type in Weston Price Diet, Sally Fallon, I wrote a really long article because they came out and spoke very strongly against Whole Foods when Whole Foods decided to adopt the Fuhrman kind of nutritarian index for their foods and rate foods according to how well they were faring in terms of nutritional content. And they just railed that Whole Foods was, you know, supporting vegetarianism and they were throwing people in the wrong direction. And it was a good back and forth, and I did a very long critical article just criticizing all the other things about it. So there's a bunch of references for you. There's his book. There's Royal Lee talking about butter and vitamin E and the X factor. There's something by Combating Cardiovascular Disease by Jeffrey Bland that was published by the Price-Pottinger Foundation. There's an article about fatty acids. There's a whole bunch of different articles that were referenced throughout the presentation with numbers. And, basically that's good stuff for you to follow up with. And that's it. I think we'll close there and we'll open it up for questions.